It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. 1,000 people move to Seattle every week. That has made rents climb. It's made longtime residents leave. One of those people who left is Alyssa Washuta. I met her on the show last summer. She was an advisor in the UW's American Indian Studies Department. She's a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and she was the writer in residence for the Fremont Bridge. She sat in the tower above the water and looked out over a city remade in a new image.
I started thinking about the process of dredging and the way that the water came in to fill that. And immediately, Lake Washington's water level dropped about 9 feet. And then slowly, over a little bit of time, it dropped 20 feet. The Black River dried up. And so my, you know, gazing out upon the ship canal began to be sort of imbued with all of these thoughts about the destruction that had happened, the displacement of Duwamish people, Duwamish villages that had been along the Black River, that happened as a result of the creation of the ship canal.
After a summer spent writing about displacement, Alyssa has moved on herself, ironically, to the capital of Ohio, named after Christopher Columbus. We might talk about that. Alyssa, welcome back to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Thanks for visiting us again. During your residency on the Fremont Bridge, which, by the way, is such a lovely image of
it,
you.
It was. It was amazing.
Amazing. You wrote this essay on the birth of Seattle as we currently know it. Would you mind reading an excerpt of that? Do you have that handy?
Yeah, I'd love to. Before this place was Seattle, it was steep hills bent all over rivers, tide flats, lakes, bogs, spirit powers, forests, people, longhouses, prairies, and other pieces of place tied together in a system of regular fluctuation and movement. Then the Bostons, the word my great-grandmother and lots of other people up and down this coast used for white men, came and wanted to put their progress into the land. The Boston men turned places into property. Terminals, shipyards, mills, railroad beds, dumps, cesspools, homesteads, parks, streets, wharves, trestles, bridges, canals. The Boston men dredged, regraded, dumped, removed, sanitized, engineered, straightened, renamed, mined, seized, settled, procreated. Where they saw useless, unsightly, progress-impeding land and water, they imagined real estate. Navigable waters, land to build upon.
You write about how all of this affected the people who were already here, people living here and hunting and fishing and playing, living life.
Yes.
And how did this displacement, how did it affect your family?
So I am Coast Salish. I'm, again, a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe and a Cascade descendant. So our ancestral territory is in southwestern Washington. So I'm not Duwamish. I'm not from the Salish Sea. So I don't speak for the Duwamish people. But we had very similar patterns of displacement in some ways. So the Cowlitz Indian Tribe sat down for treaty negotiations in 1855 at the same time that the Duwamish people and other people of the Salish Sea of this region sat down. And the Cowlitz people decided not to sign a treaty because they would have had to sign away their rights to village sites, you know, prairies and fishing places, hunting places, as you mentioned, burial grounds, you know, all these significant places that they had been, you know, inhabiting and using and, you know, working with for more than 10,000 years. So they declined to sign this treaty and were shuttled off to the Quinault Reservation on the coast, not our ancestral land, land that we had to make do with and new neighbors that we had to make do with. And I'm also Cascade. So those villages were along the Columbia River, traditionally around, you know, Celilo Falls area. And in 1856, the Cascade people were removed to Warm Springs, to Grand Ronde, to other places. Some remained along the river. So that history is very similar to the history of the Salish Sea Native peoples in some ways. Because, you know, the Duwamish people you know, have been here since time immemorial. And around the same time, in the same batch of treaties and attempts at treaty making, some Duwamish people were forced to go to reservations, Muckleshoot, Port Madison, Puyallup, other places. But a lot of Duwamish people chose to remain on their ancestral lands here in what's now Seattle.
Do you fault the white settlers of the Puget Sound area for changing the land in all the ways you described? Does it feel like a crime? Does it feel like progress with winners and losers? What do you make of it?
I acknowledge that what I learned from doing this research as part of the Fremont Bridge process is is that, you know, what I think is thought of now as kind of, I think a lot of people think of this, you know, quote unquote progress in Seattle as, having winners and losers and unintended effects on the indigenous people. I don't think that was the case. I think that the displacement of the Duwamish people was intentional. I mean, when Seattle was originally incorporated, 3 weeks after incorporation, Ordinance 5 was passed, which was an ordinance banning Native people from living in town unless they did so for working for settlers. It's important to me to underscore this idea that displacement was inflicted upon the indigenous people of this land, of, you know, many other places too, and it was intentional. And the settlers, the engineers who drained the Black River and who, undertook the other engineering projects that made Seattle what it is now, they knew that it would lead to indigenous displacement, and they decided that they wanted that to happen.
And at the very beginning, I started talking about all the people moving here and unaffordability and change, mm-hmm. and people coming and going, and you've gone too. How do you compare the displacement by force, as you said, intentional, inflicted in the mid-19th century Seattle? How do you compare that to the, softer displacement of growth, mm-hmm. and home price and lost culture and places?
I've been thinking about this, and, you know, I find it very difficult to compare the two and to, you know, compare, contrast. But I think the way that I am thinking about it is that the project of the United States has always relied upon displacement of the people who were here first. Like, that's how this country was established, through methodical, codified displacement. And so, you know, since that's not only, you know, permissible but necessary for this nation to exist, I think that, you know, makes it continue to seem necessary or like permissible for people who are living in cities to be forced out.
But forced, so you're still using the word forced out, because you write about such a literal forcing, yeah. infliction, and I wonder how you contrast that to people coming and going now.
I mean, I think, so now, you know, and I'm not any kind of expert on, you know, local, like, housing policy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I experienced it as a renter in Seattle for 10 years. But I guess my thought is that what, you know, in the 1850s, this displacement resulted from the needs, you know, perceived needs of settlers. They wanted land. And so the United States government made that happen through treaty making and through other policies that did force Native people out, or, you know, made Native people leave in some way. And so I think, you know, I haven't thought about it that much, you know, like exactly how it works and exactly how I would compare it. But I know that there is, you know, there are you know, policies that have been implemented that I think could make it easier or harder for people to remain in cities. So I think that it's similarly a sort of joint process between, you know, individual people who want to live here and the governments who put laws in place and enforce laws that have to do with living in a place.
Well, a lot of people can't afford to live in Seattle, people
right.
of all kinds.
I was one of them.
You were one of them. Do you think the city especially owes it to Native people to help them stay home this time, not move to Columbus or wherever they're going?
Yeah, absolutely. I do.
Why?
Because this was originally Native land, and there was a treaty making process in this area in southwestern Washington. You know, there's almost 2 million acres of unceded territory that was taken from the Cowlitz people. So there's, you know, very different relationships to land based on municipality. But, you know, I do think that the United States government and local governments, I do think, have obligations through the government-to-government relationship, through the trust responsibility. They have responsibilities to Native people.
What has it been like to move to when I saw that you had left to go to Columbus, it certainly jumped out at me.
It's weird.
I don't know whether you're way past it or care, but is it, you know, what's it like being, moving to a city named after Christopher Columbus?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely weird. It was definitely disturbing at first. And it's still disturbing, you know, when I type out Columbus. I think what's most disturbing is not the name, although that is, but also just being in a place where... Native people were removed from what's now Ohio so long ago. And I think there's a sense there that there's less of a presence of Native people. A few people have told me incorrectly that there were never any Native people in Ohio, which is completely untrue. And so I think there's a perception that, you know, that Native people are gone or in the past. It's very different from Seattle.
Yeah. I mean, that's so absurd, but I didn't know that Ohio was so, you know, in Seattle, I think we're so conscious, so aware of our history.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Huh. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's room for more awareness, but it's certainly more than what I'm experiencing now. But you know, there are quite a few Native people who live in the city of Columbus. I can't remember the number, but, you know, in Ohio State, we have an American Indian Studies program, and we have Native faculty there. So there's certainly Native presence in Ohio.
You know, I've heard some Native people say they've got an ethical responsibility to stay on their homelands. Was that a struggle for you?
It was.
I realized you weren't living in the Columbia. You were already in Seattle.
Right.
But how did you struggle with that?
I did. You know, I grew up in New Jersey. And so I came out here for graduate school in 2007. And, you know, that was a conscious decision to come closer to my mother's family and my tribe. And I wanted to get involved in, learning more about current Cowlitz governance and just being involved in the tribe. And through my 10 years here, I got involved in, you know, as you said, American Indian Studies at UW. I was an advisor there. I just made lots of friends and had lots of colleagues who are Coast Salish, made a lot of visits out to different people's ancestral territories. And so it was really hard to leave my land. Even though this is not my traditional territory, we share, a trade jargon. Chinook jargon was spoken up and down the coast. Some of our traditions are sort of overlapping. So it was really hard. And I'm definitely aware of the argument that Native people should, you know, should remain in the homelands. But, you know, I have to go where I have to go for work. That's basically what it came down to. I hung on here for a long time. And, you know, I was on a part-time salary and took contract work and was, you know, I think every single night going to sleep, I was doing math in my head about how much longer can I stay during my last year. And I just had to make the decision to you know, look for a job and to be willing to go wherever I needed to, basically, to in order to make rent.
Mm. So, Alyssa, grew up in New Jersey, ancestors from southwest part of Washington State. You're living in Seattle, and you're up on the Fremont Bridge, mm-hmm. and you're looking at the straightened, dredged, sluiced, drained Seattle. Can you ever feel at home?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
when do you feel at home?
I mean, I'm really happy to be back here. It definitely feels like home. And I think I thought going to Ohio that I would never be able to return. What's that? I don't remember who wrote "You Can Never Go Home Again," but that's how I felt. You know, I have several homes now. My New Jersey is home in some ways. I mean, in every way. And Seattle is home in every way. And now Ohio is becoming home. And you know, I can look at, I guess the process of looking at the ship canal was more of doing the work of actually trying to adjust how I saw it. Because before I did any research on what happened with the ship canal and Lake Washington and everything, I would walk over the ship canal all the time going from the university to Madison Park, where I used to live several years ago. So I, you know, doing that project was doing the work of re-envisioning it and seeing it as a human-made waterway that had whose creation had dramatic effects on the landscape. But you know, I mean, as far as the question of home goes, I feel at home here still, and I see it changing, and it's definitely changed since I left in July, but it's still home. New Jersey's still home, and Ohio's home too.
Alyssa, welcome back home.
Thank you.
Alyssa Washuta was an advisor in the UW's American Indian Studies Department when we met her a year ago or so, last summer. And now she's an assistant professor of creative writing at Ohio State University.
Yes.
Welcome back home. Thanks for visiting.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssa Washuta on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be back in just a moment with more of The Record.